sentence completely incoherent, which it might do. And so I deliberately put the dog at the end of the day, and so I'm at least not wasting your prime processing time. Okay, and also feel free to sleep.
You're wasting our dinner time.
Anyway, Naish persuaded me to go ahead anyway, on the basis that PI is for risky research, and we should talk about ideas before they're fully formulated and taught. So that's the spirit of this talk. Okay, so I'm going to talk about an approach to the cosmological transfer based on the cyclic universe picture. Funnily enough, it matches quite well with the requirements of the last speaker. Kination is absolutely inevitable in this scenario. As I'll explain in a moment. What is the cyclic universe picture? So it's a very simple idea. It's completely unorthodox, but it's a very simple picture, which is, imagine that I took a millimeter cube of this room, and I follow it to the future, and the universe becomes dominated by dark energy. Okay, and then imagine the dark energy is not stable. Right, so the cosmos is not a positive cosmological constant forever. It's going to fall into some negative cosmological constant state. This is completely generic. In supergravity or quantum theory, there are negative energy states, and it looks inevitable that we're going to fall into one of them. So what happens next? Well, that little millimeter, when it falls, millimeter cubed, as it falls into a negative lambda state, is going to collapse. And head straight to a singularity. Okay, so this is a fairly plausible scenario from what we know about these theories, is it's going to collapse. Now, there's two possibilities. One is that a singularity of this type, a cosmological singularity, is the end of time. Okay? And that is the one that most people think would advocate. But that's rather a disaster. The people who are trying to do physics, contemplating the end of time is not something very healthy. And so there's another possibility, which is that it isn't the end of time. And if it isn't the end of time, something is going to come out of that region. And what is required, so we had a region of the universe, what we call the prior universe, and this region tunneled into or rolled into a region of negative lambda, underwent a collapse, and something happened. And this is called a Big Crunch, Big Bang transition. Okay, and the cyclic universe rests completely on there being such a transition. And I just want to point out that there's been, over the last 5 years, a lot of work about this. Is a Big Crunch, Big Bang transition possible within M theory? And a lot of progress has been made. I don't think this is a definitive answer yet, but you can see, for example, my recent paper with Krauss and Herton, where we are studying this question within the AVKM theory, which is the holographic dual of supergravity, and indeed finding evidence that it is possible. And I've given lots of talks about this. You can look on Cursor if you want to see them. And I will be giving more in the coming months. But all of that is about this transition from crunch to bang. And as I want to emphasize, the alternative is the end of physics. I mean, the end of time. Okay, so there is no option. If you want physics, you've got to contemplate this. And the most conservative possibility is that indeed something comes out of the singularity.
Yeah.
A very basic question. Why the transition from a positive to a negative cosmological constant? So would it change the expansion and provoke a contraction?
Yes.
And then after the contraction?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
That's yes.
Yeah.
We have a theory. Well, let's think about a theory where, say, I have a positive cosmological constant,
yeah,
and I tunnel out, or I could actually just have a smooth theory and I roll off some potential and learn it goes negative,
inevitably
the universe collapses. So as soon as lambda goes negative, the universe will collapse. And see that from the Friedman equations easily. Okay, so we're trying to deal with that. But I'm not going to talk about this in this conference, because this is a cosmological constant. So I'm going to talk about the late phase of a cyclic universe. So what is a cyclic universe? It's a universe which undergoes repeated transitions from the Big Bang to Big Crunch, through this transition from positive to negative lambda, and this just continues, okay, forever. And so modulo this question of whether a transition is possible at all, which is a very difficult mathematical problem on which we're making lots of progress but don't have a final answer, and modulo that problem, the rest of it is actually very conventional. Physics, field theory, there's really not a lot controversial about it. Now, if a cyclic universe is possible, it solves the flatness and horizon and all the other problems that inflation solves in a rather simple way. I mean, are we really bothered that 1 millimeter cubed in this room is very flat and homogeneous? Not really. Nobody mentions that as a big cosmological puzzle. And if that's the patch which seeds the next universe, well, obviously it's going to be smooth and flat as well. So, and there's no horizon problem in this scenario. Furthermore, it turns out for the stability of the scenario, the stability of stable cycling, as I explained, you actually require a positive lambda. And and in fact, that's the reason the scenario was invented. When once lambda was measured and everybody threw up their arms and said, wow, this is the end of physics, we have to go to the anthropic principle. We started thinking about whether there are ways to incorporate positive lambda.
Wait, when you said 1 millimeter, are we worried about it? That would depend on what you think is the effective field theory cutoff that's dominant for the physical processes determining the background geometry at that time.
No, I'm talking about 1 millimeter today.
Today, yeah, today, but I thought you were talking about the bounds situation.
Yeah, the bounds involve string scale physics.
Today?
Not today.
Oh, okay.
No, we sit here today.
Right, right.
Lambda's going to go unstable, and then the Einstein frame.
Oh, so you're talking about the future.
With the crunch. Mm-hmm. At the crunch, stringy physics is important.
Okay.
Then you emerge from the crunch in the Big Bang. All the radiation is produced. So to deal with this transition, you definitely need to understand Planck scale physics, and that's what all this work is about.
But I see.
Got it.
This 1 millimeter.
Now, the millimeter is today. And the reason I say a millimeter, you see, in this picture, it's sort of really obvious how the flatness and horizon problems are solved. You just take a little piece of the universe. It turns out during the collapse, when you go to a negative cosmological constant, the collapse is relatively slow. The scale factor falls slowly with time. And so the universe collapses by far less than it expands due to the radiation. There's this very big asymmetry. And so essentially you can think about that 1 millimeter as almost remaining the same size as it's waiting for the crunch. And then after the bang, it expands by 10 to the 30. This is 10 to the 30 in the usual radiation epoch. And of course, that millimeter will turn into the horizon volume in the next phase of the universe. And so basically, you obviously solve the flatness problem because you take a millimeter of today's universe and you make it into a horizon. You do the same thing with the next universe itself.
Do you get a scaling variance spectrum?
Yes. So the two ways which are known of getting the scaling variance spectrum is the ekerotic mechanism, which Justin, Paul, Bert Overton and I came up with, which is that during this collapse phase, you actually have a potential which is very steep negative. This automatically generates scaling variance. In this new work with Krebs and Hertog, it emerges because the dual
the dual field theory to gravity is a conformal field theory. An unstable conformal field theory always gives scalar invariant perturbations. So that's a sort of deeper explanation. But neither of them involve inflation. Okay, so it requires a cosmological constant. The nice thing about this scenario is that most of the universe is like what we see. See, the inflationary scenario, even though it's extremely popular, most of the universe in an inflationary scenario is nothing like what we see. It's undergoing inflation, and always will be. And so the vast majority of space-time is nothing like the universe we see. And there, this brings about a huge measure problem. What's the probability to be in the pocket like ours? There's a Boltzmann brain problem. Right, most of the universe is massively expanding space. It turns out it's much more likely to create a person through a sheer quantum fluctuation than it is, because there's so much volume available, than it is to create them through the processes we were all creating. And so there are these very profound problems with inflation, which generally people don't like to talk about too much, but they're really there. So in this scenario, most of the universe is like what we see. The other thing which is important for today's talk is there's lots of time in a cyclic universe. If it cycles and cycles and cycles and cycles, it can go on cycling forever. It's a lot of time. Whereas the usual picture, the universe is effectively created 14 billion years ago. Right? Before that was just inflation, even if I have eternal inflations. Nothing like today, so there's some very different state, and then bang, universe springs into being, and 14 billion years later, the cosmological constant dominates. And that's a very weird setup. I mean, you have to set the initial conditions for our bubble universe so that lambda sits there at a 10 to the minus 100 of the energy density of the universe, somehow creating the initial condition. It sits there, and it only appears at late time. So there's no physics determining lambda, no dynamics determining lambda. It's just set in the initial condition, and then it will appear in the very late universe as being there. And so in the standard setup, it's very hard to understand any dynamical processes whereby lambda could evolve or change. For that reason, so basically it's just determined by initial conditions, and because we don't understand the initial conditions, there is no measure. This ends up being random, and we end up appealing to things we don't understand, like the anthropic principle. Okay, so within this framework, how might a cyclic universe, given that there's lots of time, how might it help you understand the cosmological constant puzzle? And so a couple of years ago, Paul Steinhardt and myself wrote a paper about that, reviving an idea of Abbott in 1985. So Abbott invented a sort of mechanism for relaxation of the cosmological constant. It does not work in a standard cosmological setup, but it turns out to work perfectly in a cyclic setup. The mechanism is very simple, that you introduce some field with a potential which looks like this. And so that's the potential, the wiggly line, V of phi, or V of chi, actually, call it. And so V is equal to a linear term plus m to the 4 cosine f. So I actually went to the first seminar Abbott gave on this. I was a graduate student, and I went to the seminar, and I thought it was the most awful idea I'd ever thought I'd ever seen. How could anyone present such a model? But then, 20 years later, I'm working on it. So I guess that tells you something. So this potential might look a little strange when you first see it. But in fact, it's based on symmetry principles. It's rather a simple, so it's a sort of theoretically, it's a technically natural potential. You imagine starting with a theorem which has a symmetry, chi goes to chi plus constant, and then you break that symmetry. So that's just a classical symmetry, and you break by, first of all, a soft linear term, which is this. And so you guarantee within perturbation theory that any quantum corrections to the potential are all going to be proportional to epsilon and powers of epsilon. And so that, so it's technically natural to tune epsilon to very small power. And we will need epsilon to be very small. Okay? So epsilon will have to be tuned to 10 to the minus 120 pi times 4. Okay, so it's tuned, but technically natural to do that. So which is a lot better than lambda? Lambda is not technically natural to tune lambda. But this parameter, it's natural to tune it to a small value. Now, on top of that, Abbott added this term, and that wasn't added by hand. That was introduced by imagining there's some other gauge sector of the theory, some other gauge fields, and when you integrate out the gauge fields, if they have, and if this field chi couples like an axion to FF dual, when you integrate out the gauge fields and the gauge fields are strongly coupled, you'll produce this cosine potential due to instanton effects. And so that's the second effect which breaks the symmetry. These are non-perturbative effects. And here it is natural for the mass m to be very much smaller than the pi mass. And that's just, that's not technically natural, that's absolutely natural for this mass to be much less than the pi mass. For example, if you work out in QCD, the scale lambda QCD, which is analogous to m, roughly speaking, it's m Planck is e to the minus 1 over alpha at m Planck. And because of because these instanton effects go like e to the 1 over alpha. So in the case of QCD, alpha at n Planck is about 1/50th, and this scale turns out to be about 100 MeV. But if you make alpha at the Planck scale 1/75th, okay, which is not that different than 1/50th, then it turns out this scale will be, and keep all the parameters of QCD the same. If you make that scale at alpha, say alpha is about 1/75th at n Planck, then you will find that this m is about 10 to the minus 3 electron volts, which is the scale you need for lambda. Okay, so here's a potential, which, as I've emphasized, is sort of technically natural. It has one tiny parameter in it, but it's natural to tune it to a small value. And then the rest of it is sort of quite reasonable from a quantum field theory point of view. Now, what's the point of this potential? Well, obviously, it's got multiple minima, so it's a bit like the landscape in that sense. it's clearly true that as that for any providing the parameters are sort of sensible, I mean, for example, we're going to pick epsilon to be less than n to the fourth, because if you made it any bigger, then there wouldn't be these minima, just be too steep and you'd roll straight down. So for that parameter choice, it's clear that there's always, for any, there always exists a minimum with V naught in this range, V naught between epsilon and zero. There always is a positive minimum within the range zero to epsilon. Okay? And
here it is in this picture. So as long as epsilon is less than 120, 10 to the minus 120, there will be some configuration of this theory which has a small cosmological constant. And that statement is independent of any other potential I add to this theory. So I'll just have this plus anything. I mean, anything can generate a lambda of any magnitude at all, and this mechanism will cancel it happily and always provide a vacuum with effectively a very small cosmological constant. Okay, so that was Abbott's idea. And as I said, I thought it was truly awful. But I guess that's a comment on the ideas which have come about since. At least as bad. Okay, so the scenario. What is the scenario?
What do you think for F?
Oh, thanks for asking. So for F, I'm just going to insist that, in fact, what I'm going to do is that I'm going to work in the parameter range F squared over M pipe squared is much less than epsilon over M to the fourth is less than 1. So this number I can take to be 0.1 or something. Things will be fine. This number, it just has to be smaller than that number. So if F is 10 to the 16 or whatever. So everything I say will actually apply over an absolutely enormous range of scales. So there's really no tuning in this model other than that, which gives around lambda. And in fact, what I'm going to do in this talk, so in our paper, we had to tune it to be around that value. But in this talk, I'm going to deal with the case where epsilon can be anything smaller than that. Okay. So epsilon can be 10 to the minus 300. And the scenario I'll describe now will still work. Okay, so what is the scenario? Well, the scenario is that you imagine you starting with some value for B much bigger than epsilon. Okay, so we imagine we start somewhere on that diagram with a large potential energy, large positive cosmological constant. Now, if V is much bigger than M prime squared, M to the fourth, then it turns out there are no barriers. Basically, the sitter temperature is so high that the field will just quantum fluctuate all over the diagram, and the barriers are irrelevant. So in that regime, you will just smoothly evolve in the potential, drift downwards. Then it turns out it's quite acute, in fact. What happens is that as you come down in potential, first you go through a regime where Hawking loss applies. So the jumps from minimum to minimum go through the Hawking loss instanton. And then the second regime is Coleman dilution. Which is a gravitational instanton, which jumps you from one minimum to the next. And the final regime is an approximately flat space-time bubble. Okay, so obviously as I'm coming down this diagram, I'm having bubble nucleation taking me from one minimum to the next. And when I get down here, the Hubble constant is pretty low, and so the expansion effect of space-time is pretty small, and basically I just go with flat space-time bubble nucleation.
So why doesn't this drive the period of inflation?
It would. Yeah, no, it does. I mean, lambda is inflation, right? So that's exactly what happens. I get stuck in the minimum, I dilute away all the matter and radiation, and wait to jump to the next one. And then the point is that each of these transitions only gives off a rather small amount of energy density. Right? When you jump down here, the actual energy involved here is like a millielectron volt to the fourth, and so that's the only energy released. And that's in fact the problem with Abbott's model. It didn't work for that reason. Yeah.
You say you can add anything. So what if I add the standard Higgs potential, which gives you 10 to the 56?
Fine. I just work in a different part of the diagram. So what I'm saying is that if I add a straight line to any constant, you can shift the line up or down. There's always a zero somewhere. So I'm quite happy to move that line up or down by anything. There'll always be a point where it's zero. That's the idea.
Yeah, so the linear part is very flat. Then the probability to jump the next stage would be very low.
Yes.
It cannot be too flat, right? So epsilon cannot be.
So I'm just going to give you the probability.
Okay.
So as you get down to the bottom, essentially the bubbles are just tunneling in flat space time. For that reason, you can see that you can jump negative. In the common dilution bubble, they speculated that maybe you can't jump to negative minima. But that was only a thin wall approximation. It's only an approximate statement. It's not true. You can easily see in this model that down here, the tunneling is just flat space. Now I don't really care about GR. And so I can go negative, and I can actually keep going. Locally, you're just nucleating a bubble in a piece of space-time that looks like Minkowski space.
So would you say it's so flat you won't go to tunnel up?
Sorry?
You say it's so close to flat you the probability to tunnel up is very small.
Zero, yeah. It's exponentially tiny to go back up. So, yeah.
For what you want to achieve is it crucial to have these steps? Why not as a simple string?
No, it's a good question. It's not crucial. It's conceptually a little bit easier to think about. We don't need these steps. You're right. We can come back to that at the end. The steps are not crucial, but they sort of help them thinking about it.
So the steps are needed for the technical model.
No, just forget about the second term. Just think that. That's all fine.
Okay.
With epsilon small enough. So you basically just drift downwards. You don't really need the steps. But as I said, the steps sort of make it slightly easier to think about. You can always gradually take them away if you want to. But sticking with the steps, I guess the steps would at least give you some comfort that you're less sensitive to initial conditions. Because it's more like a first order phase transition. You settle into a state that you follow. But it's a good question. The steps are not essential to any of the arguments. If there are steps, you can calculate the Euclidean action for the bubble. So the rate, the k rate, is proportional e to the minus Euclidean action. And this will turn out to be the flat space-time bubble, up to gravitational corrections. And these you can work out. So for a transition from n to n minus 1, the nth vacuum to the n minus 1th vacuum, the rate goes like this, m final squared, epsilon squared. That is the wall tension, the bubble wall tension, which can be calculated from the potential. It just involves the parameters, those parameters in the potential. It just involves the m to the fourth and f parameters. And then there's epsilon appearing here, and the average of the two potentials. So it's a tiny correction, because all of these numbers are much less it's actually not obvious that it's a tiny correction, but it is because m is tiny, and the bubble tension will depend on m, and basically when you work this thing out, it will be a very tiny correction. The gravitational correction is small. Essentially, you should think of the reason for the existence of that is when the Hubble constant is non-zero in the bulk vacuum, it provides a little extra kick for the field to get over the barrier. but it's a very tiny effect.
You're saying that's different than the flat space limit of common delusia because the thin wall is invalid anymore?
Thin wall is definitely not valid. Okay, so you work out the action, and for example, if I take F to be 10 to the 14, GV, epsilon over N to the 4th to be 0.1, and M to be 10 to the minus 3 electron volts, as I said, then it turns out this number is 10 to the 110. Okay, and the bubble nucleation rate is exponential of that. So it's E to the minus 10 to 110. Okay, that's the rate of jumping from this minimum to the negative one. And from here, you can see the correction is proportional to M. It's proportional to which vacuum you're in. And so basically, you have a rate which goes, which increases, you have a rate which decreases exponentially with N, with a huge coefficient here. So you're going like E, the rate is going like E to the 10 to the 110 N, right, as N increases above the zero energy, or the one that's closest to zero. And so it's obvious that you're going to spend the vast majority of the time at the last positive minimum. Okay, the fraction of the time you'll spend at that minimum is one minus e to the minus 110. Yeah.
But won't you still be spending a very long time at the other minimum? No, like
yeah.
3, 4,
yeah,
5.
Yeah, no. But the fraction in the last
you wait long enough.
It's overwhelming. Yeah, that's right. There's a lot of time.
What's that? I'm curious to know what you mean by this fine tuning being technically natural. Why is it natural?
Technically natural, a parameter is called technically natural if, when you set it zero, an exact symmetry comes into play, which enforces it being zero. It's technically natural if you introduce the parameter, but then any corrections to the potential are proportional to the parameter. Okay, so tuning it to zero is a consistent thing to do, and you don't need to worry about higher loop effects or whatever. They'll all be controlled by the same parameter.
So if you high up in the potential,
yeah.
Won't you get inflation even if you don't want it?
Oh, I don't care. I'm not prejudiced.
But you will, right?
Yeah.
Oh, there's a vacuum energy, so...
Well, vacuum energy is inflation.
Right, so...
no problem.
Will you get...
Eventually, it will drift downwards.
Well, will you get, you know, it's eternal inflation?
Yeah, you won't produce a sensible universe, if that's what your question is. It will not produce a sensible universe. And that's... So this is a great scenario for relaxing lambda to a small value. Okay, it will do that. It's technically natural. And it will start with a universe with a high lambda, with any old physics in it, and it will relax down to a small lambda. But there's a big problem, which is the empty universe problem.
Can I ask one other, just to follow up to the other?
Sure.
Why won't it keep going down? I mean, even if it takes either...
Yeah.
It'll spend even longer. It'll spend infinitely long below.
No, it'll go straight to a singularity. So as soon as it goes to the first negative minimum,
oh, I see.
Universe
collapses. Then it collapses.
In a very short time. So this kind of exponentially long time with positive lambda and almost zero time with negative lambda. Okay, so there's an empty universe problem, which I already alluded to. And that's why Abbott gave up this model, perhaps why he gave up physics shortly afterwards. He went into neuroscience, where he was very successful. And so the empty universe problem is that in getting to this last positive minimum, I've had these bouts of inflation. Every time I landed in the minimum, I inflated everything away. And the last transition is the only one that matters. And that generated 1 milli electron volt to the fourth energy density, okay, which is all I have to produce a radiation of matter. That's not very much. And so basically, the universe nucleates with an energy density of about today's energy density, and we don't have any prior cosmology at all. And so that's the empty universe problem. So that was a sort of fatal problem, which meant this model could never be used in a conventional cosmology. Now, then we came along with this cyclic universe idea, independently, and realized these two things fit together rather nicely. Because in a cyclic universe, the lambda value is just some kind of background value to this whole process. And so you sit at the last positive minimum, but during that, as you sit there, the universe undergoes many cycles of evolution. And each cycle can take a trillion years, okay? And you still have e to the 10 to the 110 years of evolution between these minima. And so you have many, many, many cycles of evolution within this. So the cyclic universe survives this, and every time you go through one of these transitions, you replenish the matter and radiation, and so the empty universe problem goes away.
But don't you heat up this scalar field back after the...
You have to make sure it's weakly coupled. Yeah. But given that the parameters are very tiny, it's plausible that it's very weakly coupled. You have to separate it all. So I guess the unpleasant thing is that you've now got a theory in which very different timescales are appearing, and they're decoupling from each other.
Oh, sorry, at least it decouples gravitational.
Yes.
So then if H varies rapidly, it would produce a lot of these particles.
Yes, so you can calculate, for example, is that field going to get disturbed by the expansion of the universe? Or by, suddenly H becomes huge. Is that going to cause kind of fluctuation of the barrier? And it won't. And these barriers are huge. So the rate of tunneling is, I mean, at least if the field really doesn't couple the standard model matter, the rate of tunneling is.
Even if you produce a gravitational, you're tending to produce high frequency modes, which would probably be inconsequential for the evolution of the solid.
Long way, like Wolfgang. Exactly. Okay, so let me just say a few words about the cyclic universe model. And so the picture we have in mind is the following. That imagine the theory of the world includes a scalar field with a potential like this. And I should emphasize sort of this part of it doesn't really matter, because it will turn out the dynamics of the field are kinetic dominated in this regime. This part I've drawn with a positive lambda, because we want that to agree with today's observed universe. So imagine there's some field with a potential like this. And this is a different field. Okay, I have this chi field, I've got this phi field. Now, the cyclic scenario, as I explained, was that imagine I start here in a universe dominated by lambda, but actually lambda's unstable. Okay, so in the future, lambda's going to decay, and it'll go negative. What happens is the field rolls down here, the universe collapses when lambda goes negative, and the field sails off to minus infinity, okay, as the scale factor goes to zero. So in a kinetic-dominated universe, phi dot is proportional to 1 over a cubed, well, actually any universe, for a pre-scale field. And so basically, as a heads to zero and a singularity, the scale field goes to infinity. Now, people would have just thrown this away as garbage, and maybe they should have, until we realized that actually such a situation where A is going to zero and phi is going to infinity is not necessarily a singularity in the theory. Okay, and I'll just explain why. You see, in this setup, if we look at the Friedman equations, and I use A pi g plus 1 as units, That's the equation for a massive scalar field in the Friedman equation. And since phi dot squared goes like 1 over 8 to the sixth, as was explained by a previous speaker, this will dominate as we head towards A equals 0. At least that's true in an isotropic universe. This term dominates, so you can forget about Hamiltonian radiation. As you go near a singularity, this will dominate.
So if you're going near a singularity, why don't you expect curvature corrections to become important?
This is why you have to study it in string theory density. And you have to read our papers about that. They are important, and in fact, you have to include all of them. It's not derivative corrections, it's the whole thing. But you can do that using holography. At least it is hoped you can do that using holography. So, let's look at this.
In earlier papers, at least the Horowitz and Hertog people argue that the string theory cannot resolve this singularity.
Hertog is working with me now.
Yes.
Maybe that's the answer.
He changed his mind.
Horowitz has not changed his mind.
Oh, right.
Horowitz is still holding out. We're having a very useful battle. Horowitz believes that cosmological singularities are like black hole singularities. And black hole-selling singularities should indeed be viewed as the end of time. Okay, that's Horowitz, it's only. But so right now, Horowitz just wrote a paper about a setup in which a black hole, in a sense, looks like a cosmology. And there's a debate, is it different, is it not, and so.
In the original paper, they don't even have a singularity without a horizon, though.
At that time, they knew very few things. Right. At that time, they did not know the correct holographic dual. Now we know it. It's ABJM theory. All this has become very precise. And so this is a real debate. I'm not saying it's settled by any means. 5 minutes. Okay. 5 minutes to solve the universe. Okay. So A goes like e to the root 165. Follows from this equation, if A is collapsing and phi is going to minus infinity. And when you see that, you realize that actually e to the minus root 2/3 phi times the 4D metric, the Einstein frame metric, will be finite at the singularity. Okay, that just follows from the Friedman equation, because the 4D Einstein metric has an A squared in it. So why is that important? Well, this is exactly what happens in Phillips Klein theory. If you're familiar with the map from 5D Einstein gravity to 4D Einstein gravity with a scalar field and electromagnetism, you'll find that this is the relationship. This is the 5D. This is the 4x4 components of the 5D metric, and they're completely finite singularity. And that's why there was this picture of colliding brains. Because the brains should be described in the 5D metric. In the 5D metric, the brains are extended. They don't shrink to a point. They're completely finite at the singularity. And in fact, in 5D, the Riemann tensor is zero all the way to the singularity in this space-time. So all the curvature corrections vanish. The same is true in M theory. If you go to M theory, which is the natural embedding for this, then the 11D metric has, near this type of singularity, the 11D metric has zero Riemann curvature. So all conceivable corrections are zero. It doesn't mean that this is an allowed solution, but at least it's one test it passes.
You know, it's still singular because the perturbations flow around the dynamic curvature will flow.
GR does not resolve singularities. That is a known statement.
So the best you can say is it's a mild singularity.
It's not even clear what that means. You have to go to a theory which is capable of resolving singularities. So GR does not resolve the singularity, even though there's zero Riemann curvature. A space can just end. A flat space can end. And that's one interpretation, is that such singularities are the end of time. But you need to go to a theory capable of dealing with such things. Okay, so that was our setup. Now, the fact that things were finite, so we could map things to finite variables, and then consider the possibility that when these two breaks collide, they bounce off each other. They just rebound, and everything remains finite. All the parameters
all the quantities in the background solution remain finite. And so what that implies, if the brain's bounces, it just implies that this phi dot goes to minus infinity, finite phi goes to minus infinity in finite time, and then it just comes back in minus infinity. So it goes off and it comes back. That's what the bounce is. And when it comes back, you're in an expanding universe. And this is where the kination comes in. That is kination. Okay, so kination is the inevitable product of a singularity of this type. When you come out of it, the universe is dominated by kinetic energy. So you come flying out of the singularity, universe is expanding, this phi dot has positive velocity, and the matter radiation affects its dynamics, but the phi dot can roll out here and end on the potential. Okay, so in this scenario, modulo this assumption about the bounce. Everything we could calculate, it agrees with all observations, e.g. WMAP, everything else in cosmology, as well as equation does. Okay, so you can make a consistent model which assumes this at this bounce. There, I should mention there's some subtleties to do with the perturbations. When you deal with perturbations, you really have to resolve the singularity, and that because you can't match the perturbations across the singularity in a sort of very obvious way without really knowing what happened at the singularity. But modulo that, this is seems to be viable. Okay, so now what I want to point out is that in this picture, the first thing to say is that there's actually a very special trajectory in such a setup, which is the one where you have no matter and radiation, and where the scalar field just reaches the zero of the potential. When V equals zero, is phi dot, is A dot. And that's when the universe turns around. Okay, so that's the solution which is time reversal symmetric around the maximum expansion point. It expands to get there, and then it recollapses. So that's a special trajectory. And if your boundary conditions at the bounce are symmetric, in other words, phi dot goes in with one value, and it comes out with the same value, but reversed, then that will be a solution of the theory. And it's the only periodic solution. Everything else will basically go haywire. Okay? If you start with too little energy and the universe collapses when you reach here, then you will get more velocity going in, then you'll get kicked further out to the right, and so on. But this one is a periodic trajectory. That's already quite interesting because you see it selects V equals zero. So it's a selection mechanism for V equals zero. That's different than the other selection mechanism, but it prefers, in a sense, V equals zero. So it prefers a lambda that's zero. So now what we do is imagine I've got this other guy in the game, and so imagine I had a potential that had a flat plateau, but I'm now going to lift it with this other field. And all the time, this cycling will continue. Okay? So this is a model which would make Abbott's setup. Okay, so now I'm running out of time, and I just want to say...
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
When you shift at the right end of the potential with the Abbott potential, what do you do with the left side?
It doesn't matter, as I said. This part actually doesn't matter. This could even be positive or negative, or it really very, very insensitive to that. Because in this region of the potential, you're kinetic dominated, and the potential really doesn't matter. So whatever you do is extremely insensitive to anything else. So the fact when I shift this one up and down, that might not be zero anymore. It really doesn't matter.
You can't really shift it up, or maybe if you shift it
doesn't matter. I mean, you could just solve the equations with a negative potential once you're kinetic dominated.
With a negative, I completely agree. With a positive, I'm not sure that I see this, but maybe.
Yeah, I mean, just think of the scaling. You see, the energy density in the scalar field when you're kinetic dominated goes like 1/6, whereas the potential energy doesn't scale. So if you're collapsing, V becomes irrelevant. Doesn't matter what its size is. So you are extremely insensitive to this part. The only part which matters is that. You can take a very extreme case. For example, I think if you make this potential steeper than e to the... Well, it's got to go negative, like bigger than root 6 pi over L pi. There's some critical value, which is, I think it's root 6. If it's more steep than that, then it will dominate. But there's a large range for which it's not relevant. I should have put a minus there. Okay, so here's the setup. And let me just draw this picture. We have all these minima. We have zero somewhere. Okay, and then in the Abbott model, we're going to make these transitions. And at every step of the diagram, we'll have many, many, many cycles of Hedipus. Okay? And we'll add this sum. Now, the objection raised to this does not explain why lambda is large enough for us to see it now. Okay, the coincidence problem. Okay? So, you see, the size of the steps, as I explained, you could tune to be small. But why should it be that lambda just came to dominate so soon after matter radiation, matter domination, for example? Why is there a coincidence between galaxy formation and lambda domination? Okay, and that's what the anthropic people are very excited about, is they think the two things are related, that lambda stops galaxy formation. And that's why it had to be as small as it is. So it's the biggest value it could be, and still allow galaxies to form. So that's what they claim they can solve, and our model does not. Okay, but the problem with their argument is that I don't really believe that we're about to be killed by lambda. In order for the anthropic explanation to work, that must be true. Okay? We only exist because this thing is on the verge of killing us. Now, when you look at the numbers, it's nowhere near killing us. I mean, you can form galaxies, it's missing by a factor of 100. And that's a huge, huge factor. So it's not plausible for that reason. We don't, to me, I don't think we are in any danger of being killed by lambda. And so I don't really believe that explanation. Plus, it's not really a theory. It's just a hand-waving argument. Okay, so the question is, can we resolve this coincidence problem? Can we imagine a setup in which actually lambda had to be as big as it is in order for the cycling to continue? And so just in the last sort of 2 minutes, if I may, I'll just write down a scenario which does that. And it's very simple. You see, this field phi generically couples to all the matter in the theory. And as you might guess from this, it generally violates the equivalence principle. The point is that there are many metrics in the theory. There's not just your 4D Einstein frame metric. Any function of phi is an equally good metric. Any function of phi times g mu is a good metric. It's still a metric, right? It transforms like a metric. So you can have any function of phi times g, and that's a metric. Now, what that actually means is that typically, all the different forms of matter will couple to different metrics. And so this phi will appear in every term in the Lagrangian, but in some different combination. And this is a completely generic feature of any extra-dimensional theory. And so one option is you just freeze that phi, and you say, okay, well, there is that ambiguity, but I'm going to imagine some dynamics which fixes phi. The other option is that you just make sure you allow it to be dynamical, like in this setup, but you have to make sure that it's coupling to matter
is unobservably weak. So here's how it couples to matter. Because it couples to the metric, it always couples to the trace of the stress tensor. And so its equation of motion, so the action always includes terms which are some function of phi times the density of the matter. Okay? And that that g of phi is a some particular function of phi. And so now when I solve the equation for phi, I'll get something like box phi is g prime of phi rho. So the density of matter sources this phi. This is therefore a new long-range force between the matter. And you have to check that that force doesn't mess up tests of the equivalence principle, and so on. And so this turns out, when you think it through, the important dimensionless quantity is defined to be g prime of phi over g. And the current limits are that beta for ordinary matter has to be less than about 10 to the minus 3. So if this coupling beta, the slope of this function g, is less than 10 to the minus 3, then you're safe with all the current tests in the solar system. So it's not really such a huge constraint, but step will take this to less than 10 to the minus 6. If they don't see anything. So it shows you step is a really great experiment to test this kind of model where you have some massless field coupling to matter. Now let me just finish by writing down its equation. And in particular, I'm going to couple it to neutrinos. And so it just couples to rho neutrino minus 3 p neutrino, because it always couples to the trace. In fact, that's what I should have written here. In general, it will couple to the trace of the stress tensor. And so it's zero for radiation, but non-zero otherwise. And then I'm going to put in some coupling to the CDN. Let's see. OK, so my scenario is very simple. The CDN contribute. I'm going to pick a positive sign. Just assume the slope of the g for CDM is positive. And so this will drive me onto that potential. So I'll come out of the singularity. Okay, radiation doesn't do much because the trace is zero, or at least very small. But when CDM takes over, it will push me up onto this potential. But the neutrinos have the opposite effect. I'm going to give them minus sign here. All numbers will be of order unity, these beta nu and beta c. And they're not constrained, of course, by these experiments. The neutrinos, I'm going to pick a minus sign here. Now, this will vanish at early times because the neutrinos are relativistic. When the neutrinos go non-relativistic, the pressure becomes negligible. And this term pushes you off the hill. Okay, so that's how this setup would work. From this, you can infer that the density of CDM at equality must be bigger than the density of lambda. Okay, if you want to have a positive lambda phase, basically the CDM is going to be strong enough to push you onto the plateau. Okay, otherwise you won't have a lambda phase and your cycling won't be stable. So that's good, because that's consistent with what we see. And then, furthermore, you can see that rho lambda must be bigger than beta of the neutrinos times the density of the neutrinos at when they go non-relativistic. The reason for that is that the only way to avoid the neutrinos pushing you off the plateau is if lambda dominates and dilutes away the neutrinos. So if lambda dominates, this term goes to a constant. You now have very strong friction. And the neutrinos will dilute away, and you'll be stuck on the plateau. Okay, so here's a setup where lambda is bounded below by the neutrino density when they go non-relativistic. And of course, it's a nice coincidence that we know that at least one of the neutrinos has a mass bigger than 0.05 electron volts. And so that provides a lower bound of lambda, you know, in a few milli electron volts to the fourth. So here's a setup. Okay, so I think there's some positive features of this setup. If this Big Crunch, Big Bang transition works, this this will be a stable mechanism for a universe which just undergoes many, many cycles. Lambda can relax. There are other positive features. You can get away with axions, with large F axions. They can also relax to their vacuum without causing any overproduction of dark matter. It's refutable in the same sense as the previous speaker mentioned. There are no gravitational waves to speak of for CMB experiments. Almost all of space would be habitable, would be like we see. No need for the anthropic principle. So there are lots of pluses, but the minuses, and I'll just leave this with you, is this Rube Goldberg? Is it too contrived? Is it too contrived to try to make a model which attracts itself towards a state of the universe like the one we see? And you know, that's a matter of opinion. I think in comparison to the other models, I would say probably not. But maybe we're all being Rube Goldbergs. So anyway, that's it. Thank you.
Question?
Yeah. So you mentioned technical naturalness. I completely agree when it comes to the linear potential and the corrections from instantons. But when you have a flat potential and the scalar coupled to matter, are you going to resurrect this problem?
That's a good question. Yeah, I mean, the way in which these scalars emerge from M-theory, so they do emerge from M-theory with absolutely flat potentials, okay? So right. There are huge numbers of them.
M-theory probably have a number of favorable conditions that are right. not us here.
That is absolutely true. So this was sort of motivated by top-down. Now, whether that flatness can survive reality is a good question. So I don't have a good answer. One presumably has to find some kind of quasi-symmetry, which is restored as phi gets large. I don't know.
What's your maximum reheating temperature here? I mean, so you start with
today, yeah,
and then do you ever go up?
Yes. So at each front, so in this brain picture, when the brains collide, some fraction of their kinetic energy goes into radiation.
And so you're proposing to make the BBN at exactly as such time?
No. Standard Big Bang scenario. So the brains collide.
Okay.
The tension of the brains is string units to the fourth. And so you just have some velocity V, kinetic energy is tension V squared. Any, you know, if V is 10 to the minus 5, you're going to UD to the gut scale.
Okay.
And then follow the conventional technology. But with an extra light scaler.
Up to gut scale.
Could be anything. It's a free parameter model. Depends on the velocity of the collision. So in principle, this is calculable using this potential, because that's what pushes you to minus infinity. But then you actually need to know the map to higher dimensions. This is something I can't explain very easily. But the velocity of the brain collision is a truly five-dimensional parameter. It's not something you can calculate from the 4D effect theory without knowing what the 5D model is. So the velocity of the collision is actually something you need to know how I got from the 5D to the 4D to compute.
So sorry for being so sense. Okay, so then after you reheat to say gut scale, then so you're going to go through a series of phase transitions, for example, if I have this in guts and I'm all separating. Yeah. And then I'm going to have a regeneration of all the latent energies into the cosmological constant from the phase transition.
Yes.
Is that right?
Yes. Now as long as that process is identical from cycle to cycle, everything will be fine. because every cycle I will see exactly the same. So I'm saying, say I'm sitting here, and I go through a cycle. Well, the physics is all the same in every cycle. And so I'm going to see exactly the same vacuum energy. And so this, when I draw this graph, this height here is the total vacuum energy, including all those other things.
Right, but then...
And because I tunnel at late times, you see, the whole setup here is that we have to change our mindset. The conventional approach to particle physics and cosmology, right, is based on the particle physics. You say, we're high energy theorists. Everything starts at high energy. Okay? The laws of nature and the initial conditions for the universe were fixed at the singularity of high energy. The cyclic model, you've got to change your mindset.
Yeah, but I'm just trying to still get how I get down to Big Bang nuclear synthesis and
every cycle you will, so in a 4D effective theory point of view, what I have is some scalar field that is running backwards and forwards. It comes out kinetic dominated, I have radiation, the radiation takes over, then the matter takes over, then the lambda.
But each transition I'm inflating, isn't that right?
No, I mean you're inflating but only in the sense that this plateau, so this the height of this plateau is the sum of this potential and that potential. Okay, and so the only inflation going on is at late times. Around the singularity, you have kinetic energy, radiation, matter. They totally dominate. I mean, lambda, you know, doesn't dominate over radiation at early times. So it only dominates at late times. That's why inflation is upside down. I mean, inflation, you're trying to make lambda dominate in the beginning. That requires fine-tuning. I mean, you have to say, well, for some mysterious reason, the radiation and matter was negligible at the beginning of inflation. Okay, in this scenario, lambda only matters at late times. And so you can call it inflation, but equally you could just say it's dark energy. So basically I'll go through one of these bounces, I'll land up here, this height is the low energy vacuum energy, right? And then the universe will recollapse, fill up with energy again, and I'll come back to exactly the same point. But over many, many cycles, this field could tunnel. So there may be billions of cycles of this field. You know, tunnel down here, billions of cycles, and then I'll come down to here and I'll undergo e to the 10 to the 110 cycles. Okay, before I crash to nowhere. And there's some worse singularity out of which who knows what emerges. Yeah.
It seems to be we are running out of time.
Thank you.